Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. Hope you guys are doing fantastic today. Today we're going to talk about something very, very unique that I'm really curious about for a while. Something that I want to learn about also. With us, we have Chris Bennett. Chris is an expert of self-storage, and we're going to hear all about that. Chris, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate
it. Ishai, thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it, man.
No problem. You know what? Before we dig into your story, let's do this. Tell us, give us like a 2-minute elevator pitch about what your business is about.
Yeah. We buy self-storage facilities in growing markets in business-friendly states. Typical size of a facility is institutional size, so call that 40 to 50,000 square feet and above. We try to group them together in little portfolios, and then the goal is to sell them off and call it maybe 3 to 5 years to an institutional group or a REIT that has a bit lower cost of capital than we do. So we can hopefully get that portfolio premium by doing so. So that's the business in a nutshell.
Beautiful. I love it. It was very concise and very specific, and we have a lot to talk about. Yeah. You know, before we get into it, tell us about yourself, how you got into this whole thing, commercial real estate and to self-storage. Let's go back in time.
Yeah.
All the way through.
Yeah. That's not a problem, man. I'm happy to share the story there. So 2007, got my real estate license. And wow. Actually, at the time of...
what a year. What a year to get a real estate license.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that. So like, it's actually August 20th. So as of the time of this recording, it's September 1st. So literally, what is that, 15 years ago? Yeah, I got my real estate license and started August 20th, 2007. My real estate class was completely packed, you know, the pre-licensing course and all they got to take, all the hours. We were packed, like maybe, I don't know, 150 people, 200 people in the room. Wow. And we're all going to be rich, right? We're going to go do real estate and kill it. And little did we know what was around the corner, right? In 08, 09 and all that. So fortunately or unfortunately, I guess, but fortunately, we were working with a lot of banks and asset managers to list foreclosures for sale. And I would do obviously the listings and work with investors, and most of them were buying houses with cash to build a rental portfolio. So you had some smart cookies back then who were buying up properties. Had we known what was happening, I would have bought every single thing and be a billionaire, but hindsight's 2020. It was an interesting time. Actually got burned out on it, to make a long story short, because I seen so many. I would do the grunt work, meaning so when a property is foreclosed on, there's a timeline for the person to get out or whatever. You show up there with the sheriff's deputy to evict them, and they're supposed to be gone. Yeah. And all their stuff is supposed to be out of the property, et cetera. But oftentimes it wasn't. So you actually drill the locks out of the doors. The sheriff's deputy knocks on the door. Nobody answers the door. Usually you drill the locks out of the doors. And let me tell you, you think your lock is secure. It is not. It takes like 60 seconds to drill one of those dead bolts and handles and all that out of the door. But anyway, you drill that out, you get in the house, a sheriff deputy walks through to make sure nobody's in there hiding in a closet, you know, that kind of thing. And then they hang out for a little bit while you go and change all the locks, take pictures, and now the home is owned by the bank. And then we would hopefully relist that for sale. We give them a broker price opinion at BPO and tell them what we think it's worth. And then we relist that for sale down the road. So I was involved in that work.
Was it multifamily or single family or both?
Mm-mm. All single family.
All single
no
family.
Multifamily. Yeah, wow. No multifamily. So that's part of the story. So
that's a crazy story.
Yeah, you probably, probably out of all the podcast interviews that people listeners of your show, you probably haven't heard too many people talk about that side of things. So I was doing the literal work for the bank.
It's unbelievable.
Which wasn't pretty. Yeah, which wasn't pretty. So I actually got burned out, man.
Right.
Let me keep going and then I'll fill in the details. So I got burned out because one of the last ones, we were doing that very work, changing locks and all that. A kid was walking up the drive. He was walking down the street. I didn't really pay much attention. Then he started walking up the driveway and it turned out the house that we were foreclosing on and changing locks and everything was his home. When we got inside the house, nothing was gone. It was like as if we almost broke in the house, like, and people were there because there was literal food on the breakfast table sitting there. It was like a little eerie because we thought the sheriff's deputy thought somebody was hiding in the back or whatever. But they know full well there's a notice placed on the door. They know like when their eviction date is. So this one had not been, the person had not vacated the premises. So it turned out that the mom was working, a single mom working a job. Or she had sent her son down the street to go stay the night at a friend's house. She was at work at like Chick-fil-A or something like that. And the dad had walked out on them. We found out later on that when the son came home, he was like 8 or 9 or something.
Wow.
It was heartbreaking. Yeah, heartbreaking. The sheriff's deputy was a lady. She was crying. I mean, that work sucked. So I didn't want to do that anymore. I decided to go off to
school. I can tell.
Yeah, get an education and do other things. I wanted to go do something else. I didn't like real estate because of my experience there. Let me fill that in here in a second. Cause like, oh, wait, you like real estate? Are you doing real estate? Okay. So I didn't like real estate. Want to go get an education. I went to school, community college, and I transferred to UNC Chapel Hill, which is a great school. I found out about commercial real estate there because the only job I could find in my first summer there was working for a guy who was syndicating equity to buy multifamily apartments. And that was literally the only job I could find. So it's kind of ironic how that worked out. I wanted to get away from real estate and go do some super nerdy Asian math stuff because I'm half Korean, but only job I could find was in real estate. So I got there and he was buying a portfolio of like 16 properties or whatever, I forgot what the number was, but I had never seen so many zeros. I was doing the underwriting and I didn't really know how to underwrite. So he was teaching me and it was very different than single family homes and all that, obviously. And I realized he was buying, you know, at one, a complex, like 150 units at one time. And I saw the income for each one and the price per door and all this stuff. And I'm like, man, he's buying this whole thing, like whatever it was at that time, like call it 120 a door. I don't remember 120,000 a door, which is way cheaper, right, than buying an actual house. And you got to do all the work for each house. He's buying 160 homes at one time, essentially. The light bulb clicked. I was like, you can do this? Like, this is, you know, so then I realized he was raising a fund and he syndicated the equity and he did this and he did that. And his name is Daniel Eller. So he and I cross paths pretty often, actually about once a year at a conference up in Chapel Hill. But he gave me my start. Eller Capital Partners is the name of the company. You can look him up. Anyway, so then I realized, this is the way it's done. You go out and you buy a bunch of units at one time in multifamily. And then you go and, you know, execute the plan and sell and make money and rinse and repeat. So I got into a lot of the weeds there, but that's the whole story. And then I graduated. I worked for a company in Raleigh, North Carolina. We were doing multifamily acquisitions. I was their director of acquisitions, which is just a fancy title for bird dog. Go find deals, get deals closed, you know, that sort of thing. And so that's what I was doing. We ended up pivoting to self-storage. Everybody was really interested in that side of the
business.
Which
year was that?
Yeah, that was 2016. 2016, I graduated. 2016, 2017, we raised our first self-storage fund. We used CrowdStreet to help raise some of the equity for it and went out and bought like 6, 7, I forget how many facilities, mostly mom and pops. So like smaller, maybe $2 million average purchase price, which is small in self-storage. But with that, you can buy 150, 200, 300 units. Individual units. So it's nice in that sense. So anyway, so that's the story, man. And I'm sticking to it, but that's the story. And I fell in love. I was able to compare the two, multifamily versus storage, and just the opportunity within the storage space at that time. I loved it and it made a lot of sense to me. So that's why I decided to focus there. So that's the long, long story short, man, how I got into the self-storage business. It wasn't like on purpose.
I think it's very exciting. And I'll tell you something. We're going to dig into the comparison in a minute, but I just want to, you know, I reflect on it. It's such an incredible story. I never heard, like you said, I never interviewed someone who was at the front of a vacating people.
I
could tell it took a toll and everything. And the story with the 8-year-old kid was heartbreaking, literally.
Yes. Yeah.
And I can tell you, moving to, you know, hearing your story and moving towards what you did, moving and learning about multifamily, which was obviously, you know, light bulb came up, understanding the whole concept of commercial real estate and scalable type of business, different type of style of things.
Absolutely.
And obvious. But then you made a pivot into storage. And that's a different business. If you could weigh for us what you saw so different there that intrigued you and, you know, the details in terms of where are the differences when you underwrite a deal in self-storage versus the multifamily. We obviously understand the concepts, but the inside stuff that you are so experienced with, we want to understand.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a couple of differences and kind of the high level things. First off the bat, I kind of alluded to it a little bit earlier that like we were buying, call it on average, $2 million properties. So some of them were less than that, some of them were more than that, but somewhere in that range. You can buy maybe 200 units, 250 units at that price point. Which is different than multifamily. If you have $2 million in multifamily, maybe you're buying 10 to 20 unit, you know, complexes, something like that. Maybe it's a little bit bigger, depends on the market and quality, et cetera. But you get the idea that you can buy more units with less dollars, right? And so your vacancy risk isn't as great because you're buying more units with less dollars. On the flip side of that is your rents can be comparably, so your net operating income is, as far as dollars are concerned, are less, right? And so if you have $1 per foot in rent and storage for a 10 by 10 unit, $1 per foot in rent per month, that's $100 a month that you're collecting on that unit. That's $1,200 a year, right? And then after your expenses, whatever, of course, it's $1,200 a year for that unit. Whereas if you have $1 per foot rent in multifamily and it's a 1,000 square foot apartment, I think most listeners can do the math, right? And so you're looking at $12,000 annually in income for that one unit. So 1200 versus 12,000, you're looking at different numbers. So if you bought a $2 million facility, obviously you can apply a cap rate and all that kind of stuff, but maybe you're making, you know, 150 after debt service, or not, excuse me, not 150, maybe you're making less than $100,000 after debt service. Now you put fewer dollars into it at a $2 million purchase price. You maybe have to come up with or raise, you know, $500,000, a little bit more for the CapEx. So your raise is very small compared to buying a multifamily apartment. Another thing to think about as far as a pro, based upon my experience with evicting people and dealing with people's situations, right, personal lives and whatnot, in storage, if somebody doesn't pay, you don't evict them. You do what's called an auction. And people have heard like storage wars and all that. That's all fakery. What you need to do is actually, what we do is you just do it all online. It's all kind of like eBay almost. You go and you bid on whatever unit, there's photos and all that kind of stuff. So that's what we do, is we auction off the goods. And nobody has a sob story about my goods being auctioned off because they're just your stuff. It's not you personally being kicked out of a unit, you know? So there's like less emotion in that sense involved. Rental rate increases. This is a pro where if I raise rents on that $100 unit that I mentioned earlier on by 5%, that's $5 a month. That's the cost of a latte. Actually, that's less than the cost of a latte these days. But if I raise the rents 5% on a multifamily apartment complex unit, it might be $50 or a little bit more than that, which is a little bit different situation, right? People are trying to determine whether they can buy gas or live. You know, it's kind of a grocery expenses going up, et cetera. So that can have a more meaningful impact in someone's life versus the $5 rental rate increase. And in reality, as of the time of this recording, if any of your listeners want to go in and just Google the recent REITs like Public Storage, Extra Space, CubeSmart, et cetera, and see what their revenue increases were quarter over quarter and their NOI increases were quarter over quarter, they have ranged from anywhere from 15 to almost 25, a little over 25% which is insane, the amount of rent growth right now in self-storage. So now, again, that's the REITs. That's not every single facility, but it just gives you an idea of the possibilities there. So, and then there's good financing options as well, which we can talk about if you want to, but those
we'll get into that.
Sure.
Why is pricing going up? Because inflation, because of other reasons, is mm-hmm. there?
Yeah, that's essentially it. So they've had expenses that have increased as well, but it's easier again to push. Okay, so if I have $100, if I have a unit that rents for $100 a month and I raise your rent 15%, that means that your rent went up to $115. Hardly a reason to go call all your friends or your family members and get so mad that you rent a truck, drive it down there, load up the truck and spend an entire day unpacking your unit and trying to figure out where to put all the stuff.
Right.
So, you know, it's not worth the hassle is essentially what it is. So it's a sticky tenant base. Some people will move out, but the majority end up staying and they're able to increase rents on the current tenants at that rate.
Tell me something. When you talk about vacancy in multifamily, in a good area, you're talking about 90% occupancy to 94%, 95% sometimes more.
Yeah, sometimes higher.
When you're talking about storage, what type of vacancy occupancy ratios are you looking at?
Yeah, if we're in the high, let's say if we're like at 95%, we know that's too high. We want that physical occupancy closer to around 90-ish percent. That's good in storage. That means you have plenty of units of a couple of different sizes to be able to rent to people when there is demand there. Same concept as in multifamily. Economic occupancy can be around 85%. So in other words, you're not collecting on every single person there. Maybe rents are just a little bit under what you're asking on your website, et cetera, but roughly 85-ish percent economic, 90% physical is considered stabilized in self-storage.
Interesting. Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Let's talk about financing a little bit.
Yeah.
How do the banks look at such a deal? How do they treat it? What type of rates you get? What type of LTC you get? Or LTV, whatever.
Yeah.
The refinancing options.
Yes. So just from a big picture perspective, there are many options, many lenders who are willing to finance self-storage. A good way to acquire financing or at least get some different quotes, et cetera, or get feedback is to use a self-storage debt broker. That's what we typically do. We do have some relationships direct, but we like to use a debt broker, a couple of debt brokers that we know that do a good job of outsourcing that debt for us. So there are plenty of lenders that are willing to lend in the self-storage space, more so now than there were before because of the, and that's one thing I didn't mention as far as a pro of self-storage or a positive is that during the last recession, in 08, 09, when I was doing the foreclosure work, the data on self-storage, it was one of the only asset classes that had a positive return as far as publicly traded REITs are concerned. So out of all the multifamily, data centers, you know, whatever you want to think of, mobile home parks, et cetera. Self-storage was one of the only ones that had a positive return during that time. And then again, during the pandemic, same story. And so because you have that data to back it up, you have a lot of lenders and institutional capital willing to lend in self-storage. So there's no shortage of options. As far as getting into the specifics, it depends on the type of asset. Same thing in multifamily or anything else, right? Depends on the sponsor, the strength of the sponsor, the location of the asset,
right,
the market where it's located,
right,
all that stuff. That's the same kind of stuff.
Right.
When you have something that checks all the boxes, if something checks all those boxes and it's a great deal or whatever, what's the strategy there? Is it a value add situation? Do you need permanent financing? On the permanent financing side, let's just say it's fully occupied. You're just going to buy it and maybe do a few things, but you don't need to do much work to it. So it's more stabilized property. You can get bank debt, life company debt. There's all kinds of debt options out there, even for some smaller deals as well. So, and there's local banks and credit unions that will lend on that kind of stuff too. But you can get rates right now. I know rates are a little bit higher than what we're used to as of the time of this recording. But let's say if it's a good size deal, 40,000 square feet, fully stabilized, your LTV, your LTC might be around 60, 65% if you're getting bank financing on something like that. And then your rate is going to be around, I'd say, the mid fives. It could be the low fives, depending on the deal, the size, but somewhere in that 5% range, which is actually pretty good considering what's happening in the market right now. If you have, again, let's say it checks all the boxes for market sponsor deal, et cetera, you know, characteristics, but it's a value add deal. You got to go in, you know, put some CapEx into it, paint it, whatever, get the
occupancy. That's exactly what I wanted to ask you.
Yeah.
Can you give us some examples, you know, of CapEx, the value add play there? Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So let's say you're talking to the lender and this is the story. It's a mom and pop deal. It's maybe call it 50,000 square feet. They built it themselves. They've owned it for 20 years. They haven't raised rates in 3 or 4 years, which is, this is a common story. They haven't raised rates in 3 or 4 years. They do have a website in this case. A lot of them, sometimes they won't have a website, or you can't rent on their website. They just have a website that's kind of static and you got to call them to rent a unit. But let's say they have at least the website kind of side of things down. So you're going to go in there. It needs to be fixed up. It needs to be painted. It needs to be refreshed. Let's say the drive aisles are gravel. They're not paved. Usually a lender's going to want you to pave that. So you go in, you're going to say, we're going to pave, we're going to paint, we're going to have an updated or refreshed website. We're going to use a call center. We're not going to have anybody on site because it's, we think we can run it that way. That's a whole nother topic we can talk about as well, as far as operations are concerned. But those are some of the value add components. In some cases, they won't have a website that can rent. They won't have that at all. You need to have that in place. They won't have a Google My Business. They won't have a listing online on Google Maps or anything like that, which is kind of crazy, unheard of. In our, like, you know, world, but they're out there. Those kinds of facilities are out there. So, and then they don't raise rates. That's the biggest side of things. They don't raise rates, or they kind of pride themselves on having almost 100% occupancy, not having raised rates, and they do tenant insurance.
Wigan?
What's that? Like mom and pops. Mom and pop owners. They pride themselves oftentimes on not raising rates and having very, very high occupancy. In some cases, I understand if you're in your 60s and you're, you know, holding on this for retirement or whatever,
you don't want to risk it.
You fear a drop in occupancy, right? So I get that. I understand that. But for us, that's a value add play. And that's the biggest portion of it. Sure, you can do all the things to make it look pretty and whatnot, which is important. But the biggest part is, can you raise rates by how much? And then can you add other things like tenant insurance? Can you charge admin fees, lock fees? Are you selling boxes and whatnot on site? You don't get much with that. And really, we usually remove it anyway. But it is an option for some operators. They add like the boxes and packing tape and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
If they're going to sell it on site, you make a little bit of money from that. And then parking. Sometimes you'll see places that are underutilized as far as parking is concerned. And it's very easy to go in. And if you have a little bit of space there to literally like just stripe. Like, you know, here's a parking spot and rent that for $50 a month or $100 a month, whatever parking is in that market. So really the revenue side of the business is most important, what we're going to do there. And then the CapEx side, signage, paint, paving, maybe new gate, maybe a new website, those kinds of things are very simple and kind of, you know, kind of no brainer things. But oftentimes we'll see where mom and pops don't keep up with what needs to be done there.
But it sounds to me that you're more going after for core plus type of deals.
It depends. We have a mix. But I forgot. I wanted to answer the question about. I forgot. Never. We got off on the CapEx thing. So if you're going to a lender,
yeah.
And this is the story there, right? Okay, it's going to be a bridge debt deal, meaning the debt service coverage ratio, the debt yield is going to be very low, comparatively speaking. And so they're saying, okay, your debt service coverage ratio is less than 1, for example. And if people don't know what that is, we won't get to the details on that. But the point is that it's not paying enough to get permanent financing. Yeah. So your debt service coverage ratio is 1 or less or something like that. So it's going to be a bridge deal. On bridge deals, usually it's a 3-year interest-only loan. The rate's a bit higher. So let's call it somewhere in the mid-6s right now. And then if you need to, or you might want to price in purchasing a rate cap at this point, or really it's a rate swap, but a rate cap so that the rate won't go much higher, because on that type of loan, it's floating rate debt. So whatever the Fed decides to do, if they bump their rates, it's going to affect your loan situation. So, and then your LTC on that could be a little bit higher, maybe 65%, 70%. It just depends on the story there. You can go lower, get fewer dollars from the lender, but keep the rate a little bit lower. So it really just depends on what you want to do and how it fits into your overall portfolio. But the idea is that you're going to fix whatever the problems are and then refinance out within 3 years.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. You could have an extension there if you wanted to. Sometimes there's a plus one, so 3 plus 1. So very similar to multifamily is the way that they'll structure those types of deals.
Tell me something. When you talk about risk factors, what are the risk factors when it comes to, you know, the storage space?
Oh man, zero, no risk whatsoever. No, I'm playing. I'm just kidding. There's always this similar risk as compared to multifamily, where development, right? So more supply coming in is probably the biggest risk factor. If you're in a market where, hey, there's three or four deals under construction, that's going to hit your ability to raise rates, because once all those deals come out of the ground and they open up for business, They're gonna you know, do the dollar, like Public Storage is very famous for the dollar move-in special, right? So you can move in for a dollar for your first month. And that's really gonna make it hard for you as an operator owner in that market to maybe raise rates. Now, if the market is undersupplied, that may not be a problem, because let's say there's very little storage in the market. They're building new homes or population's growing or whatever, and you exist and there's another one coming in down the street, but they're not coming out of the ground for another year or so. And then another year before they actually, about 18 months before they actually open their doors. Well, that's not really going to affect you in the short term, maybe a little bit in the long run, but it's not a huge deal, because if you're already undersupplied, there's really nothing to be worried about in that situation. So really it depends on the market.
So let me get into the specifics. I'm sorry, I'm stopping you.
No, go for it.
I'm curious about one thing. Development is always a risk no matter where you build. Hotels, multifamily, condo development, retail, doesn't matter. Self-storage, always a risk. You always don't know what will happen. I heard once, John Gray from Blackstone saying that they do development, but less, obviously, because you don't know what you'll meet, what type of market you're going to meet in any place in 3 years. And that's what it takes. 2 or 3 years, it's going to be maybe a different world. You don't know. That's the risk you're taking. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the risk where you're talking about, for example, I'll give you a live example. When you're talking about multifamily is the most resilient asset class to be considered, right? Why? Because everybody needs a roof, over their head. Everybody says that. But okay, the risk factor there is that the area is moving. Now, in retail, you have different type of risks, right? You have the area, obviously, everybody's moving to a different retail area that is more attractive, and this area is going to be, it's going to be harder to get leased. So that's one factor. The other factor is obviously e-commerce, whatever is happening, whatever Amazon did to the rest, and the world's changing, all that stuff. And then you have hospitality, different risks. That's what I'm talking about. When a neighborhood self-storage facility is at risk, do you have a red flag? You see what's going on around you and you're saying, boom, people not going to need the self-storage. Is there anything like it or no?
I've heard anecdotally that Public Storage, the former CEO of Public Storage, said our only competition is the garbage can. That's the risk factors when people say I don't need this stuff anymore. And it sounds far-fetched, but it's really not. And the reason why self-storage is driven by changes in people's lives. So when somebody passes away, somebody gets a divorce, somebody's downsizing, which are things that happen during recessions, they use self-storage more. When people are moving up, they're moving from one job to another. Now we have remote work. People are making spaces in their house for work from home. That trend is still continuing. They need self-storage. And so pointing back again to the data, it's really easy. Let me back up for a second. It's easy for me. All right, if you walk into a barbershop and you ask them, do I need a little bit of trim on the sides and whatnot? They're going to tell you yes every single time. Well, I can clean up your neck a little bit, even though you don't need it, right? So it sounds like I'm saying I'm a barber, right? I'm saying, yeah, self-storage is great. It's the most wonderful thing ever. If you look at the data from REIT.com, anybody can go there and search for the data, download it, and play with it themselves. They can see that self-storage performed well during the last two recessions during the pandemic and 08-09. And it's continued to perform well since then. If they Google the Wall Street Journal, I'm a subscriber to it. It's a trusted source, right? So just Google Wall Street Journal self-storage. Just Google that or self-storage pandemic. There's several articles out there about how self-storage performed during the pandemic from a trusted third-party source talking about the resilience of self-storage. Personally, I would never use self-storage. I rent a unit, but I don't put anything in it. I just rent a unit just to keep up with what they're doing as far as raising rates, et cetera. I've rented from REITs before, from our own facilities to make sure our manager is staying up with everything. From that, like you can see, okay, I forgot where my train of thought was going there. So most people don't use storage and they can't imagine using storage because I'm like that. I just throw stuff away if I don't need it. But typically people need storage during a change in their life, and change is happening whether there's a recession or not. And change happens a lot during a recession. So if we're going into a recession, sure, there's risk. There's always risk from, again, overdevelopment, et cetera. But generally speaking, it's driven by need. And then people tend to stay longer than they expect because it's a big hassle to go and get your friends and get all your stuff and move it out. Unless you were already planning to do that because you're getting a house built or something like that. That's a little bit different. But people tend to stay longer once they have a unit than they expect. So yes, there's risks. The biggest ones come from people deciding they don't need their stuff. And then obviously development, et cetera, is a big risk factor within the self-storage space. I say that because self-storage is successful in a rural market. I've seen facilities in markets in the mountains and other places that are fully occupied that do extremely well. I know a guy who bought one. It was a small deal out in the mountains of North Carolina. He's adding on more units and he took it to market. He bought it probably about 2 years ago, took it to market recently and sold it. There is a buyer demand for self-storage facilities. So yes, there's risk that's going to be local to a market. Of course, if there could be an environmental disaster, jobs could be changing. You might buy in a market where there's only one big industry. Maybe it's a manufacturing town and that town is shutting down or something like that. You know, those kind of stories, which that's not where we buy facilities, but even then, facilities can still do well. I've seen them out like in Wadesboro, North Carolina, other places where they have 100% occupancy and it's nuts. You wonder like, why are people storing stuff here? It's the middle of the country, like in the country. You should have space to put things, but yet their stuff is in self-storage. So it's an interesting asset class and it's backed very up by data. Yeah.
It's very interesting. Yeah. What I'm curious about two things. I'm going to ask you one by one because they're unrelated.
Sure.
One is, first of all, in terms of the management, you guys manage also, or you hire a third party?
We have a third party company that we use. So right now we're using Atomic Storage Group that manages for us. And yeah, that's we hand that off to them. We'll probably become vertically integrated at some point, have our own management company in-house. But that takes a little bit of time to build that out and whatnot. So yeah.
Right. Okay, so that's great. And the other thing is, how do investors, I'm sure you guys deal with investors, how do you guys see the market in terms of the investors, meaning obviously investors are going mostly to multifamily, people who do retail tend to find less investors, and for the other asset classes as well. How do you guys experience it? Is there like a fleet just like for industrial people are going also for self-storage? You feel that investors are running? And what type of education is required in order to get the investors? And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, kind of the same. So for education, it's kind of the same kind of conversation that we're having. So we put out content, whether it be a podcast or webinars. We do biweekly webinars talking about self-storage of a YouTube channel. And then we have a newsletter that goes out as well. Educating investors on whatever we might be seeing in the market or whatnot. So we do that and put that content out there. We get a lot of people, at least at passiveinvesting.com, we get a lot of people that come in because of the multifamily side of the business, but they're doing their research too, and they want self-storage. And so they have pivoted, obviously added self-storage to their portfolio because of all the things that I talked about, doing their own research, finding articles, et cetera, talking about the asset class. I think back in 2016-17, when I first got into self-storage, there was really only, I had to kind of educate myself on the industry, and I found a few books and materials and things, but really there was only one book that I can recall that was for sale at the time talking about self-storage and buying it and all that stuff, and how to underwrite it and whatnot. And I read it like 3 or 4 times. But since then, there's been like 4, 5, 6 books that have come out from whether it be brokers or their operators or whatever, talking about the self-storage industry. There's been more news and media discussion and more consolidation within the industry. There's articles on Seeking Alpha and other places talking about the resilience and wonderful asset class that self-storage is. So, and podcasts as well, talking about self-storage investing. So in other words, the education has just, I think, ballooned as far as the information that's out there on the self-storage industry, which helps all of us who are raising capital. We don't have to start from scratch. Yeah, to educate everybody on the self-storage business.
Tell me something, in terms of location and areas that you guys prefer to invest in.
Yeah.
What are your, any preference?
Yeah, typically Southeast, the Southeast, Texas and Colorado. Arizona, we'll look at deals there as well. We just looked at a deal in Indiana. It didn't work out for us, but looked at the deal in Indiana. Coincidentally, Indiana just ranked number 8, I think it was, in most business-friendly states, which kind of surprised me. So we were looking at some deals there as well. But if you're going to, let's say that a person is a passive investor, they work a full-time job that they love and they want to just invest passively in deals, you know, typically the markets we go into are not going to be the ones that are head scratchers. They're going to be the ones that you, oh yeah, okay, Houston, great. Denver, Colorado, okay, great. Greenville, South Carolina, okay, great. Like there's not much that has to be done to educate an investor on that. We are invested in a couple of deals in a place called Mebane. It looks like Mebane, but Mebane, North Carolina. But if somebody just Googles that real quick on Google Maps or whatever, you'll see it's about 25 minutes west of UNC Chapel Hill and the Raleigh-Durham Triangle area. And I went to Chapel Hill, so I know the area very well. So it's a growing submarket of that area.
I have a crazy question for you. I'm sorry for stopping you. It's very, meaning I'm really intrigued, meaning I love this conversation. I'll tell you something. It sounds to me, and you obviously prefer the, you know, the Texas area and the growing markets and the stable markets where everybody's moving out to. Obviously, everybody's running from California into Texas. So it's obviously
from California originally.
Without a doubt. But so that's a different conversation. But what I want to ask you is the following. You know, meaning being, I'm based in New York, basically. Right now, I'm not in New York, actually. But being based in New York is a place where a lot of people who are from New York tend to invest much less in New York and go to other areas, obviously, for you know, obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Cap rates are low. And also, whatever New York went through and is going through still. Mm-hmm. But here's the question. A place like New York, I'm taking it as an example. You're going to Texas, but the most, in terms of density, right? And in terms of the need for storage, in a place like Manhattan, it sounds to me like that's the best place. Am I wrong? Are we missing something here?
No. It's just what we prefer. So New York tends to not be... New York tends to not be super Brit business friendly. New York City, at least, tends to not be very business friendly. And it makes it tough sometimes. I know that applies usually more to residential and, you know, with rent.
Rent control and all that stuff.
Yeah, rent control and all that stuff. Yeah. So, but it just as a whole, it doesn't tend to be business friendly. So we stay out of it. Not that it's a bad market because I think recently, was it Public Storage or somebody like that? They bought like a massive portfolio that was concentrated in New York. Somebody else did the same, like Extra Space or Life Storage, I think it was. They did the same thing. They bought a big portfolio that was in New York. New York's not going to go away. Of course, it's going through its ups and downs, you know, as far as with COVID. And then just right now, I think the socioeconomic situation that's going on there. But you're right. Like, it's not going to go away. It's not going to become some bad rural market. It's just our preference. That's all. Just like some investors prefer core plus or core assets versus value add because of risk or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. We just prefer the Southeast and maybe some other states versus New York, but no, by no means. Public Storage and Life Storage are some of the smartest guys out there and they bought in New York and that's fine. The prices can tend to be very high too for a comparable facility and the cap rate's extremely low. And so to try and match that up with our investors with what they're looking for makes it, that's nearly impossible to do. So for us.
Very interesting. When you go, and you choose the properties and you look for the properties. I'm sure there are specific brokers that do self-storage. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now, okay, you're looking for those?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Beginning that you're looking for portfolios many times. Can you tell a little bit about that strategy?
Yeah, no, we'll look at both. There's some portfolios that hit the market. It's a portfolio can be hit or miss because they'll have some locations in markets where we're not interested in.
Yeah,
exactly. And so that's kind of tough sometimes. If it's a portfolio that's concentrated in a market where we want to be, then obviously we'll take a hard look at that and underwrite it. We'll look at mostly single, like one-off deals, because that's what's the majority of what's out there. And then we try to put it together. If we can, it's the like in multifamily, the more debt, the higher purchase price, obviously, the higher the LTV or LTC, so the higher the debt. Number amount that you need to borrow. And if you need to borrow more, your terms get more favorable.
Risk.
So it's the same story in self-storage. The bigger the debt piece, the better the terms can be. So your rate might be better or whatever, or non-recourse versus recourse. So anyway,
that's a big deal.
So yeah. Yeah. So we'll try and package them together if we can, but it doesn't always work that way. So we'll definitely look at one-off deals and portfolio deals as they come in, either one.
Give me an example for a property, for a self-storage property that you won't touch, like the bad deal.
Yeah, well, I had to check the box for the market first. And so if it's in the wrong market, we won't look at it. It's a delete, you know, from the inbox. If it's a small deal, we won't look at that either. So anything under $5 million is going to be a smaller deal for us. And that just doesn't make sense for us. But a bad deal, let's say it's a bad deal. A bad deal, sometimes there can be an issue where it's not really, it's storage, but it's like kind of like Frankenstein storage, where it's like, you got some of the portable units and then you have like a warehouse and then you have like something else that's there and you have
not
some
organized,
units. Yeah. And you have some,
the not too defined. Doors,
so, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So you have some weird things like that. And that's a little bit, that's not really what we want to buy because our exit, we got to think about our exit. Our exit is going to be typically to a REIT or whoever, right? Blackstone or whomever is going to buy self-storage, which they're in the business, by the way. Bill Gates is in the business. I didn't mention that either. So he's in the business of self-storage. So anyway, we want to exit to those guys, right? Because they only have to pay a 3% return to their investors. So they could pay a lot more. And so it's got to fit that box of, okay, is it storage? Does it make sense? Is it big enough? Would they buy it from us? And that's how we kind of make our decisions. So it can be ugly. We bought a real ugly one. But it's a big, it's almost 100,000 square feet. We bought two of those. They're ugly, right? Different color buildings, all this stuff. And that's fine. We can go in and fix that. But the point is that the size allows us to exit to a REIT. Ugly is okay. Nothing wrong with that. It's just got to be like storage or
Chris,
parking.
I'll tell you something. I'm loving this conversation. We learned so much from you. And I really appreciate your time. And, it was really interesting. You also, how do you say, you explain it so beautifully. I love that.
Oh, thanks, man.
So I really, really appreciate that. And you know what? It was a true lesson. You really gave us value here. And I appreciate that. So, and I'm going to start thinking about self-storage in a much more serious way.
Yeah.
I think this is exciting. And, everybody, you guys that are listening, I'm sure you learned as much as I did. And I'm sure you guys appreciate Chris also. Chris, tell everybody, please, how they can find you. Guys can see the links above, below, wherever. Chris, tell us, please.
Absolutely. You can always find me on LinkedIn. Just search, obviously, or click the link or whatever. But I'm out there on LinkedIn posting content there. You can find me on Facebook as well. I have a public profile on Facebook, so you can find me there. You can always shoot me an email, Chris, K-R-I-S, at passiveinvesting.com. We are on our Fund 2. We're closing out that raise. So if you're interested in investing in self-storage with us, we're closing out Fund 2 right now. So go ahead and reach out to us. You can also go to our website, passiveinvesting.com, and sign up for our newsletter there, our Passive Investor Club. And we'll keep you up to date on future funds that we have for self-storage. But we're doing Fund 2 right now. We're looking for more deals for Fund 3. So if you want to invest with us, go ahead and reach out and happy to fill you in on all the details.
You know what, guys? I love it. And I'm sure you guys, if you're interested in investing in self-storage or joining Chris or learning more from Chris, you can contact him directly. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Chris, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate you.
Yes, I appreciate it, man. Yeah, had a good time.
Thank you so much. And you guys, stick around. You guys, I'm going to see you in the next show. Take care. Hey, guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.